Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. Today, I will be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Senior Policy Director, Mark Goldwine, at the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News, where we will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that the Senate plans to revive the stagnated appropriations process for fiscal year 2020, which we are already in, by taking up a package of four spending bills this week that already have bipartisan support. Those four bills going to the floor include agriculture, commerce, justice, science, interior, environment, and transportation HUD. Senate leaders hope this is a stepping stone for their top priority, funding the military. Senate Democrats have voiced support for the package of four bills, but not the bill for military and defense spending. The defense bill may be considered as part of a package that would also include funds to combat the opioid epidemic, even though such funding would normally be part of the Labor HHS education bill. But the Appropriations Committee put that bill on hold last month because an abortion policy amendment that Republicans considered a poison pill. Because of partisan disputes on issues like a border wall and abortion policies, the Senate has not passed any of the 12 spending bills for the fiscal year that began October 1st. We're currently operating on a continuing resolution that goes until November. The state-run marketplace created by the Affordable Care Act appear to be mostly stable after years of uncertainty. Now, in many states, premiums are becoming more predictable, increasing only slightly or remaining flat. Some states will see rates fall after adopting policies aimed at reducing costs. However, the rate of uninsured people across the nation has crept up during the Trump administration, and there are ongoing lawsuits aimed at undermining or even overturning the entire health care law. Senate Democrats are working to repeal two executive branch rules that could impact the budget. One target is a Treasury rule aimed at cracking down on states that have tried to evade a new limit on deductions households can take on state and local taxes. The other target to overturn is White House guidance on health insurance that gives states waivers to offer lower-cost insurance plans, which Democrats have called, quote, junk insurance, that would undermine the ACA, including the requirement of covering pre-existing conditions. Democrats hope to use the Congressional Review Act, giving them 60 legislative days to overturn a new agency rules, which only requires a simple majority and is not subject to filibuster. There are now questions surrounding the distribution of aid to farmers intended to support those harmed by the U.S. and China trade war. The Agriculture Department is being accused of favoring southern farmers in the distribution of funds. The deputy secretary denied any such claims, saying calculations for distributions have been made on a consistent basis without regard for regional location. Up next, Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, Mark Goldwine, will join me to discuss Goldwine's recent paper on Social Security reform. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Mark Goldwine and Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby. You know Bob well. He's a regular contributor. Mark is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. He conducts research on a wide variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget. In 2010, Mark served as Associate Director of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. And in 2011, he was a Senior Budget Analyst on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. That same year, he was featured in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for law and policy. He has also conducted research for the Government Accountability Office, the World Bank, the Historians Office at the Social Security Administration, and the Institute of Government Studies at UC Berkeley. Mark teaches economics at the University of California, D.C., and at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Mark.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show, and today we're going to take a deep dive into a very broad and large topic, one that is routinely referenced as the third rail of politics. So we're discussing, most people might know by now, Social Security. Mark actually helped write a report with some of his colleagues at the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget that focuses on this topic. It's one of five papers that the Concord Coalition has included in its fiscally responsible economic growth agenda that it's in the process of rolling out. But before we get into the weeds of the paper, I think it'd be smart, Bob, for you to jump in here and share why Social Security is even being considered in this new fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, and then we'll roll into the topic itself.
Well, a couple of reasons. One, the economic growth agenda includes fiscal sustainability, and Social Security is the largest federal program, and it currently faces a relatively large and growing deficit on a cash-in, cash-out basis that contributes to the federal budget deficit. So putting the budget on a long-term sustainability basis requires some reforms to Social Security to put that program on a sustainable basis. But beyond that, Social Security sends a lot of economic incentives to people, whether to, you know, work and save incentives, and you know how long you stay in the workforce, how much savings you do prior to retirement, and so the program itself is part of, you know, if you're going to think about long-term economic growth, you think about things that can be done through the Social Security system that might enhance long-term economic growth. And I think the unique thing about the paper that Mark has written is that it's written from the perspective of Social Security reform as an economic growth strategy, not just a menu of options to raise revenue or cut benefits.
And I do want to get into the details of the proposal itself, but you mentioned, Bob, that Social Security is on an unsustainable path, that it's a huge factor in the overall fiscal picture for our nation. Can you and Mark maybe bounce off of each other here and give us a snippet on, you know, what makes it unsustainable? I think a lot of people have the perception that, well, it has dedicated revenues through a payroll tax. It has a trust fund. So why is it that this system is being, I guess, seemingly attacked or picked on over the years on it being sustainable or not sustainable?
Well, I'd hardly describe Social Security as being attacked or picked on. It's often called the third rail of American politics because if you touch it, you're dead.
So, all right, picked on from a rhetorical sense.
The reason that people talk about Social Security reform is not that it's a bad program. It's that the, you know, just as a very basic matter, the revenue coming in from the payroll tax is not sufficient to pay the benefits going out. And that's a phenomenon that's occurred since 2010. Long projected to occur as the baby boomers began to collect benefits, and the gap simply gets wider. So at its very, very fundamental level, to make the system sustainable, you'd either have to raise revenues or lower projected benefits.
Right. Well, Social Security is unsustainable exactly because it does have dedicated revenue in a trust fund. The problem is the amount we pay in the payroll tax isn't enough to pay for benefits. And while we do have some reserves, those are projected to run out in just 15 years. Think about that. A 62-year-old retiring today will be 77 or 78 when Social Security Trust Fund runs out. So this isn't like we need to fix it for our great-grandkids. We actually need to fix Social Security for today's retirees, or we can't promise them their full benefits over their lifetime.
And Bob, you mentioned the sort of unique perspective that CRFB and Mark brought to the table with this report, and it's, in part because of the overarching agenda that we're throwing out there in terms of it being pro-growth, pro-economic growth agenda. So my question for you, Mark, is, is this sort of perspective on Social Security reform, is it different than past proposals by, say, other commissions over the years or other organizations? And if it is different, how so?
Sure. So we've as a country have been talking for almost 2.5 decades about saving Social Security from its looming insolvency. And at times we've talked about, we've had other discussions along with it. Should we make more of Social Security about private accounts and savings? Should we expand benefits? Should we fix Social Security as part of the overall fiscal picture? And those are all important discussions. But never before have we really looked at Social Security specifically as an engine for economic growth. And frankly, we haven't needed to before because historically we've grown at about 3% a year, which is great. But going forward, because of our aging population, we're projected to grow at less than 2% a year. And so we're going to need all the engines we can to kind of get us at least on that right side of 2%. And if you think about Social Security, the amount that we raise in Social Security taxes plus spend and benefits is more than the income tax, right? Social Security is the largest tax most people pay, the largest retirement benefit that most people receive, the biggest single contributor to the budget deficit, and sends powerful signals to people about how much to save, how to invest, and how long to work. That means that Social Security is potentially an incredibly powerful tool to boost economic growth.
Mark, does this proposal, which we're about to get into here, does it take a bipartisan approach, or are these policies that are actionable in the near term? I know you mentioned the need for action even with current retirees because of the possibility of a loss of benefits because of the trust fund. But how realistic are some of these changes or proposals within this plan?
Well, I don't think that our plan is going to be enacted in its entirety without revision. That's not the goal here. The number one goal here is to change the discussion about Social Security so we understand that fixing it is a key to economic growth. And the number two goal is to begin to put forward the right types of ideas that can get us there. Now, within our plan, we have a number of elements that can go together or can be separated out. And what I hope will happen is that policymakers will take the parts they like best, modify them to meet their other goals, and put them into a package that will both save Social Security and get our growth rate up.
All right, let's talk about those elements. Can you give us a high-level view of the overall proposed package before we start talking specifically about each one?
Sure. So I think it's easiest to explain this package by thinking about our goals. And essentially, we have four goals out of this plan. Number one is to promote delayed retirement and productive aging. In terms of economic growth goals, our number one way we grow the economy is to promote delayed retirement and productive aging. The second way we grow the economy is to reward work at all ages. The third way is to increase savings and investment throughout the economy. And the fourth way and final way is to improve the predictability and sustainability of these programs. Now, we achieve these four goals through different means. The first goal we achieve in part by raising the retirement age, but also creating a new safety net benefit so everybody, regardless of when they retire, is guaranteed a poverty-level benefit. The second we achieve by essentially changing the benefits are calculated so all years of work are rewarded equally rather than the disparate way it is today. The third is we increase savings by automatically enrolling people into retirement accounts on top of Social Security. And the last is we propose a mixture of progressive benefit and tax changes designed to bring the system's cost and spending, cost and revenue in line.
So, Mark, you just rattled off a great summary of the four, I guess, prongs, I'll call them, or goals within this particular plan. You rattled off some of the potential overall revenues to achieve those. Let's back up a step and let's go through that first goal, promoting delayed retirement and productive aging. Walk us through in a little more detail what that means and what would have to change to achieve that goal. And a lingering question in the back of my mind is how might this particular goal impact younger generations, especially if you're encouraging a delayed retirement and perhaps a need for younger generations to advance in their own careers, but maybe there's a backstop or a bit of a backlog ahead of them.
Sure. So I think there's a couple important things to understand. The first is that over the last half century, Americans have been living longer, but have actually been retiring earlier. And the second thing to understand is that there is a breadth of economic evidence that most people would actually be better off retiring later and in more flexible ways than they do now. People that work longer end up with higher wealth and income in retirement. The Urban Institute's estimated each year you delay your retirement is about a 9% boost to your average income in retirement. People that work longer tend to live longer. As a result of working longer, they are healthier. They have healthier mental and physical health. They have broader social networks. They drink less. They have better marriages with fewer divorces. There's a whole variety of reasons that people are actually better off by retiring later. And, oh, by the way, it would boost the economy because people would contribute more to the labor market. The problem is Social Security currently sends a signal that basically tells people to either retire at 62 or retire at 66, the normal retirement age and early retirement age. What we do is we raise those ages. We raise them to 63 and eventually 68, and then we index them for longevity. So as life expectancy grows, so too will the retirement age. But to make sure that people that cannot work longer don't have to, we also create a new poverty protection benefit at age 62 that anyone can begin collecting so that nobody will be forced to live in poverty if they can't keep working past age 62. And the idea here isn't to get everyone to work longer. It's to get everybody to work the amount that is best for them. For some folks, that will be delayed retirement. For others, that will be phased retirement or transition jobs or encore careers or switching to part-time or moving to consulting or starting their own business. And for some, it will still be early retirement. But the Social Security system shouldn't be sending people signals to retire earlier than what is best for them.
As for the poverty protection element there, allowing people to still engage in early retirement at 62, do you have a sense of how that would compare to the, I guess, average benefit or current benefits that for someone who might retire early? Is it essentially a net gain, or are they going to experience maybe a lower benefit threshold there for taking earlier retirement?
So the way that this works is under the current system, your benefit is reduced if you retire early. What this sort of does is two things. The one is it puts a floor on how much that benefit can be reduced at the poverty level. So nobody's going to get lower than a poverty level benefit. For people in the low end of the spectrum, that will actually be an increase. For people at the higher end of the spectrum, in theory, they're going to take their existing benefit. But what this also does is it lets people continue to retire at 62 even as we raise the early age. So you're going to be told your early age is 64, for example. But if you really need to retire earlier, you can take a poverty protection benefit for a couple years, starting at 62, and then transition onto your normal benefit.
Is there an aspect to this, Mark, that really speaks to the productive aging piece there? I know you mentioned some of the benefits of working longer and thus, as a result, not taking your retirement benefits through Social Security earlier. But are there any other aspects of this policy that hone in on encouraging productive aging as opposed to just, you know, in a sense, delaying retirement?
Well, I think delaying retirement is the key to productive aging or switching to, again, these more flexible arrangements. But we can't do this with Social Security alone. Social Security needs to be a piece of a broader strategy that includes a rethinking of our spending policies, our tax policies, our regulatory policies, and frankly, our employer and employee culture. And I think we need as a country to move away from this idea that you do the same thing every day of your life, and then one day you switch, and towards the new types of arrangements where people can make the choices that are best for them.
I think that that's an important point, because as the workforce changes, there'll be more people that might want to stay in the workforce, but maybe not work as many hours, to your point about having other people move up in the chain. I hope that's not a comment about the Concord Coalition.
No, absolutely not.
Wanting to have the older generations retire and move up. But anyway, no, I think that it's important to think about the changing workforce, and we have another paper in this series that does look at workforce training and retraining and education and re-education as we're going to need as we have changing technologies and this demographic shift. We do need to look at more than Social Security policy, but as part of encouraging people to stay in the workforce longer, the federal government does have a role in programs, as does the private sector, in making that change and in facilitating that ability.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director at CRFB, Mark Goldwein. We're discussing a new report by CRFB that Mark helped write on reforming Social Security to make it more sustainable. And Mark, you were right in the middle of the four goals of the proposal. We covered pretty well, I think, the first goal, promoting delayed retirement and productive aging. I do want to turn to the second goal, and that is reward working at all ages. And you spoke a little bit about that earlier on. Can you give us a broader view of what that means and what kind of changes would be in store for the system?
Sure. So the current Social Security benefit formula, almost by accident, really punishes work in later years. The way it works is there's a progressive benefit formula that essentially says we're going to give you a high replacement rate if you have low earnings and a lower replacement rate if you have high earnings. But because the earnings are measured over the average, what that essentially means is that each year you work gets a lower return on your dollars than the prior year. And once you're over 35 years, you almost get no return because we only capture your highest 35 years. So what we say in our plan is let's count every year equally. And that means get rid of that cap at 35 years. It also means no minimum amount of work at 10 years. And it means apply the benefit formula to each year of work so that we're actually being progressive based on your annual income, not saying that early years count a lot and late years barely count at all.
I think that's a really interesting perspective, and I have a few questions that sort of come from that. And one specifically is about that 10-year minimum. So are you saying in this proposal you could collect Social Security benefits if you only, say, worked 2 years over the course of your lifetime?
That's right. Under the current formula, there's essentially a 10-year vesting. And that actually kind of makes sense because of the way the benefit formula works. If we let people with only 5 years of work vest, they could have very high earnings, but the system would treat them as if they were poor and give them a very high return. But under our proposal, where each year is counted individually, your benefit is based on your income in each year. And so if you work 5 years, your benefit won't be very large. But yes, you will get benefits in exchange for those taxes that you paid.
And with this proposal, Mark, are you anticipating, I guess, a larger average benefit per person up to a certain income threshold, you know, across the spectrum? How does this play out in terms of the level of benefits being paid in Social Security?
So this particular element of the proposal is going to increase benefits for some folks and decrease for others. It'll increase benefits for people that work less than 10 years, work more than 35 years, and have relatively steady earnings. It's going to decrease benefits for people that have relatively intermittent earnings, especially people that make a lot of money for some years and not very much for others. But what's important is we don't view this proposal as something that should be enacted in isolation, but part of our overall plan. And our overall plan includes a number of measures to boost benefits at the bottom, slow their growth at the top, make the system sustainable in a way that also strengthens retirement security.
So since we're on the topic, why don't we take, I guess, that goal out of order here? I think you're getting into, I guess, the fourth prong, improving the certainty and sustainability of the program, and it might tie into what you just said. So why don't you give us a glimpse of what that looks like and what changes might be involved with that part of the proposal?
Look, so making Social Security solvent has really a large number of economic benefits just by itself. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office did an estimate, and they found that if you made Social Security solvent in the absolute dumbest way possible, an across-the-board benefit cut when the trust fund runs out, the economy would be 2 or 3% larger after 30 years. So if the dumbest way possible can grow the economy to 2 or 3%, imagine how much making it solvent in a smart way could do. And there's a few reasons for this. First of all, making Social Security solvent actually reduces our projected debt levels because we assume there's basically going to be a large general revenue transfer to cover that shortfall. And if we don't have to borrow that from the private sector, we're not crowding out private investment. We're not sort of weighing down the economy with high levels of debt. And the lower debt can help to boost productivity, increase capital, and ultimately increase wage growth. But secondly, when people have some certainty about what their benefits are going to be, they can save and work and make other adjustments appropriately. And there have been a number of studies done that found that people would much rather know their benefit today, even if it's lower, than have that uncertainty. They'd be willing to give up, in fact, as much as 10% of their benefit just to have certainty of what it is so that they can plan and adjust. And that planning and adjusting can actually result in better overall allocation of resources in the economy and thus stronger economic growth.
Mark, I apologize if I missed this, and you pointed out that the dumbest reform possible would be to just let the trust fund run dry and see an across-the-board cut in Social Security benefits, and that could actually produce economic growth. But you're saying targeted reforms to make it more sustainable could elevate that projected economic growth, or at least its impact on economic growth. Do you have, a value associated with this plan on what kind of economic growth, if all these things were taken into consideration and pursued?
Right. We have a very broad range. We estimate our plan is going to increase GNP, gross national product, by somewhere between 3.5% and 13% by 2050. Now, I know that's a broad range, but it reflects the uncertainty, but the direction is clear. If you took the average of that, that's about an 8% boost to the economy, which is the equivalent of a quarter point boost in economic growth each and every year. That'd be huge. That'd be the equivalent of $8,000 per person of economic additional economic activity in 2050 alone.
And Bob, I've been monopolizing this part of the conversation. Do you have any questions you want to jump in here for Mark?
Well, I'd like to circle back to the third element that we didn't get to, which is the provision of individual retirement accounts and introducing that into the Social Security system. I think you have kind of an interesting and unique way of doing that. So why don't you describe that?
Sure. So as I mentioned, a lot of this is about promoting work and improving sustainability, but another key to economic growth is more investment in the economy. And what's the best source of investment? It's savings. And so what we need to do is improve the amount that people save. But we want to do it in a way that is flexible, that gives people access to relatively low fee, lowish risk, but decent return investments. And the way that we do it is we automatically deduct a couple points from everybody's payroll on top of the payroll tax that goes into a private retirement account, a supplemental retirement account that they own. But this is voluntary. So at any point, someone can say, you know what? I actually have some big expenses this year. I don't want to save from retirement, and they can opt out. We think that opt-out approach gives people the flexibility they need, but the automation means that most people will do that savings each year. And as they do, it's not only going to help them prepare for their own retirement security, it's also going to increase the investment in the overall economy and thus provide an extra boost to economic growth.
It's worth noting that this issue sometimes gets caught up in the debates that we used to have about Social Security privatization, quote-unquote. Some of the earlier proposals would actually carve that money out of the current system so that the money would come out of the current payroll tax, which is already insufficient to pay the benefits, as we were talking about. And that raised a lot of objections from people in earlier years when President Bush, for example, proposed Social Security accounts. And I think I've always found that the word privatization sometimes frightens people because they think, well, that means that Social Security is going to go away as it is, and we're all on our own to do the savings. And so it's worth underscoring that this system, I think you said, is the accounts would be funded by a new addition to the payroll tax. It wouldn't come out of the current system, and people would have the opportunity to opt out of it if they didn't want to.
That's right. This is completely voluntary, and it is on top of, supplemental to Social Security, not meant as a replacement.
So it doesn't increase the deficit, because one of the arguments about the so-called carve-out accounts was that they would just further increase the deficit in Social Security. Obviously, the way that you've designed it, that wouldn't be a problem in this case, and it wouldn't contribute in that sense to Social Security solvency. It's really something aimed at increasing personal savings and savings for the economy, and also individual savings and wealth accumulation.
You could argue these supplemental retirement accounts aren't even part of Social Security reform, and there's actually a number of ways to skin this cat. Right? There's lots of different ideas for automatic universal retirement accounts, and we're not wed to this approach. But one advantage of doing it at the same time as you do Social Security is you get to give people the security that they're still going to have the retirement resources they need. You get to take advantage of the fact that we already have a pretty good system for deducting people's wages and through the payroll tax, and we can use that again for for a plan to offer them sort of some broad index funds where they can get a pretty good return with a low fee. And as I mentioned, this can contribute to the overall economic growth rate and really reinforce the other elements of Social Security reform that are in our plan.
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head right there, Mark, because the question in the back of my mind was, this sounds like it could be done even outside of Social Security reform, because this doesn't sound like it's actually part of the Social Security system. But you made, a pretty quality argument there in terms of, well, if we're going to do this reform in the retirement system, we might as well add this as part of it because we're doing it all at once, sort of as a package deal. But one of the questions I had, maybe even a little bit of a concern, is is there an administrative burden cost that comes along with this sort of add-on in terms of managing those, you know, particular investment plans? Or is this something where, well, it's going to be a public-private partnership, but the government's collecting the revenue to fund it?
So there will be administrative costs associated with running this retirement plan, just with any retirement plan. But the government already knows how to do it. We do it right now through the Thrift Savings Plan for federal employees. And what we've learned is that actually we can do this at much lower fees than the way that people currently save through their IRAs or even their 401ks. And so we shouldn't pretend that investing is free. It's not free of risk, and it's not free of administrative cost. But an advantage to this approach is, especially for low-income folks, where fees could be eating a lot of their savings in on the private side, we have the ability to do this at relatively low cost, low risk, high return.
And I think you might have mentioned this as well, Mark, but I think you said it might be a couple percentage points on top of the existing payroll tax. Am I right in here? Did I hear that correctly, or can you give us a more precise figure?
Yeah,
on...
so we left this a little bit vague in our plan. We said a retirement account that's equal to 2 or 3%. We are not wed to the details of our plan. We're not wed to things like, what is the tax treatment? Like how many investment funds are there. That's not the purpose of our plan. It's not legislative text. The idea is to get the discussion moving on developing a way to save Social Security that's also pro-growth and improves retirement security in the process.
And speaking of saving Social Security, one of the questions I had in the past, previous plans with commissions or even legislation aimed at like a 75-year solvency window in terms of extending the life of Social Security. Do you have any kind of target like that associated with this plan?
Yeah, I it's almost not worth doing Social Security reform if you're not going to make sure that it's sustainable over the next 75 years and beyond. The ideal target assures the trust funds around for 75 years, assures that you bring cost and revenue basically in line at the end of that window, so you have confidence about the long term, and has elements that are robust to changes in the economy. So, for example, we index our age to life expectancy. That means that if life expectancy grows much faster than we think, the age will rise faster. If life expectancy grows much slower, it'll grow slower. And I think that's a smart idea, because anyone that says they can tell you life expectancy 75 years from now is either lying or an actuary.
And even the actuaries might be lying.
That was a joke.
No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah,
it could be a lying actuary.
A lactuary. Anyway, terrible puns. I guess I want to take a step back and look at this from the big picture, since we're talking about the 75-year window and the overall goal of sustainability. And I want to look at the generational impact. You mentioned earlier that these reforms are probably necessary to help existing beneficiaries or those about to become beneficiaries because of the life of the trust fund. What does this do in terms of an impact on millennials and younger generations? Specifically on, are we looking at, you know, a higher tax rate, a higher taxable maximum, a longer retirement age or a later retirement age for them? What is the intergenerational impact here of a plan like this?
Sure. So I think we need to be honest with the American people. As a country, we missed our chance to save Social Security in a way that spread the burden truly in a truly fair way. The baby boomers are now all in retirement, and we're not going to make cuts to people currently in retirement. So that means that more of the burden will fall on younger generations. And that means that, yes, higher earning millennials and whatever the next generation, Generation Z, if you earn enough that you make above $130,000, $140,000 a year, you're going to pay a bit more in taxes. And if you are lucky enough to earn a lot over your lifetime, your benefits are going to be a bit lower than they would be under current law. But your benefits are going to be higher than they would have been under what's affordable with the current revenue than under trust fund insolvency, and you're going to benefit from a faster growing economy. That's going to mean that by 2050, on average, your income is going to be $8,000 per person larger. And yes, you may work a little longer, but as we've shown from the science, it's probably going to mean that you have more friends, that you're happier, that you're healthier, that you're more likely to stay in your marriage, and that you have more income in retirement. So, look, there's no free lunches here, and younger generations, especially the higher earners, the younger generations, are going to have to contribute a little more, but they're going to get a lot out of it. And most importantly, they're going to have a sustainable system that they know they can count on when they reach retirement.
Who would have thought working longer would have given me more friends and helped my marriage?
it's counterintuitive until you think about it for about a second, right? But in the United States, we really build a lot of our social networks around our work. And even people, this isn't just people that sort of desk jobs or office jobs, even people in factory jobs still find that when they're at work, they're socializing more, they're happier, they're healthier, and they're not annoying their spouse, therefore reducing their overall divorce rate.
That is a fair point. Speaking from spousal experience, I think that might be hard to avoid given that we're expecting a child very soon, so my life will be very hectic. We're running low on time, and I did have one question left that I wanted to see if we can get an answer on. This goes back to something I alluded to earlier, sort of the bipartisan aspect of all this and the fact that it's the third rail of politics. Can a policy proposal like this help take Social Security off that third rail?
That's what I'm hoping. What I'm hoping is if we can reframe this discussion to be about whether we're going to raise taxes or cut spending and make it about how we're going to grow the economy for everyone, I hope there's an opening where the parties can get together. It's not a given. You know, I've studied Social Security, the politics of Social Security, and it's really hard to do anything outside of a crisis. But given that the trust fund crisis isn't going to be for another 15 years, at that point it may be too late, we need to try other ways of thinking about this. And a positive message that we can actually get faster economic growth, I hope will be helpful to this overall discussion. And it's something that both Democrats and Republicans should want to support, because we all benefit when our wages are growing faster.
Chase, let me just add that, I mean, I think for a program like Social Security, which is so important for everybody and that does have political sensibility, you have to do reforms in a bipartisan way or they simply won't work. And so, you know, anybody that's got a my way or the highway attitude is not really contributing to solving the problem. They're actually an obstacle. So I think that a program that has things that some things might appeal to one side and some things might appeal to the other, but the important thing is that it comes out in a place where the system is sustainably solvent.
Yeah, and I think the my way or the highway perspective has been a hard one for me to stomach over the years. I don't enjoy the fact that this topic has been lost in rhetoric for so long, and it is a difficult conversation publicly, obviously, because we're talking about impacts to different generations, but I'm of the opinion that I think we're better off jumping on this third rail sooner rather than later, because changes later will become more difficult and probably less bipartisan and less economic growth oriented and more survival mentality. And I'm a planner. I would rather have a more in-depth knowledge of what my retirement might look like, and having some predictability in Social Security would help in that planning. So I certainly commend you, Mark, for being one of those members of a younger generation and taking a bipartisan look at trying to tackle this issue. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Senior Vice President at CRFB, Mark Goldwine. We discussed a new report by CRFB that Mark helped write on reforming Social Security to make it more sustainable and to actually help boost economic growth. Thank you for joining the show once again, Mark and Bob.
Thanks, Chase. Thank you.
We'll be back after these short messages for our final segment, Facing the Facts. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and this is our final segment, Facing the Facts, where I share with you a fact or a piece of information that I think is worth you pondering until next week's show. So, it's time to face this fact. Since it was the primary topic of today's show,
It is worth a reminder of one of the 25 lessons that the Concord Coalition has learned in its now 25 plus years of existence. Doing nothing is not a plan to fix Social Security. Social Security is the largest program in the federal budget, accounting for about one quarter of government spending. The program consists of two components, old age and survivor's insurance, which provides benefits to nearly 50 million retired individuals and their dependents and their survivors. And then there's disability insurance, which pays benefits to more than 13 million workers with disabilities and their dependents. Social Security is partly funded by a 6.2% payroll tax paid by employees and an equal amount by their employers on wages up to a cap known as the taxable maximum, which is about $135,000 in 2019. Before 2010, revenue from payroll taxes was sufficient to cover the costs of benefits. But since then, Social Security has consistently spent more than it has received from payroll taxes, and the gap is only going to grow larger in the future. The reason for Social Security's long-term shortfall is largely changing demographics. There were 5 working-age individuals paying into the system for every individual receiving benefits in 1960. Today, that ratio is close to 3-1. By 2034, it will fall further to roughly 2-1 and plateau there for several decades. When the ratio of taxpayers to beneficiaries falls, taxes either need to be increased or benefits need to be reduced to close the resulting financial shortfall. Some believe that this can wait several years because of the program's trust fund, which tracks the balance between incoming revenues and outgoing spending and enables previous year's surpluses to be credited towards future deficits. The combined Social Security Trust Fund for Disability Insurance and Old Age and Survivor's Insurance won't technically be exhausted until about 2035. But the logic of waiting for reform until then is deeply misguided. Between now and the projected trust fund insolvency date, Social Security is projected to spend roughly $3 trillion more than it will raise in dedicated revenues. Because the trust fund is entirely invested in government bonds and the federal government is already running deficits, the government will have to borrow from the public to finance the shortfall. Once the trust fund is exhausted, current law would require an across-the-board benefit cut of nearly 25%. Such a sudden and steep benefit cut would significantly harm most retirees who rely on Social Security for substantial parts of their incomes. This is particularly true for beneficiaries with fewer resources, in part because the benefit formula favors them in terms of what they receive relative to what they paid into the system as workers. Whether policymakers choose to close Social Security's shortfall with tax increases, benefit reductions, or a combination of the two, it would be best to phase them in gradually and give beneficiaries and employers time to adjust their finances. Doing nothing and allowing a crisis to threaten the retirement security of tens of millions of Americans is not an acceptable plan. You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.